Amen. I went to seminary a long time ago. Before many of you were born. And one semester, I can recall getting finally to schedule a class, a missions introduction class, that I'd heard so much about and wanted to be in, because not only was the professor I was going to take, Dr. Cal Guy, a great teacher, but he was also had a great heart, and he had a great spirit of worship and faith. So I went into that classroom with anticipation. It was a wonderful experience. It was in about 1965. Dr. Guy started to teach at Southwestern Seminary in 1946, and he taught there for 36 years. Probably he has trained more missionaries and helped to train more missionaries than anybody else in our whole fellowship of Southern Baptist, and maybe anybody beyond that. We are privileged this semester to have him on our campus as an adjunctive teacher. He is teaching a full load, three courses, and I want to encourage you that if you're not enrolled in one of his courses, you'll wish you had been. This is an opportunity to have to be exposed to and be around Dr. Cal Guy. One of the things that I heard early on as a young man, people told me, you can learn best by just hanging around the best people. And that's what you want to do, take advantage of being in his class. I know that probably everybody's schedule is set, but take advantage as much as you can. But we're privileged to have him come and preach today. And I know that God will bless as you hear him prayerfully. And one day you'll probably be able to say to your children or to another generation, I heard Cal Guy at Southeastern in January of 96. Before he comes, we have a group called Damascus Road. Head yourselves on up here, gentlemen. And I envy these men because of their hair.
Thank you guys for that music and gals and orchestra and Rand. It was so much fun to hear Rand just turn you loose to have fun singing that song, because our music people out at Southwestern always tried to sort of keep it from getting out of hand. And if we got too loud, they just sort of calmed it down. So we'd wait till chapel was over and go to the parlor and gather around the piano and sing Farther Along. We'd just get on with it that way. The Sacred School of Music at Southwestern nearly killed church music and church attendance, too. They got that stuff so high it took two ladders to get up there to where it was. We were about to die. If people wanted that kind of music, they could always go to Episcopalian Church. And they did it better. And then something happened. If you were here a long time ago, they got a drama called Good News. Good News. And the kids brought in their guitars. I call them stomach Steinways. And they broke the hold of that be very solemn as you sing thing. You're supposed to come to church in those days with a face long enough to drink buttermilk out of one of those churns. You've ever broken into a smile, something cracked, and so it was just come and be solemn with us and don't get too excited. It's sort of like the legend around Oklahoma Baptist University that said one time they had a dean of women there who wanted to train those girls off of the farms and ranches to be real, real ladies. So she would say to them, now girls, when you go to the football games and you want to encourage the young men who are there, act like ladies. Don't yell and scream and show your tonsils. But if you want to help them, wave your handkerchief and say, press them fiercely, boys, press them fiercely. So we got to church with press them fiercely thing. And I heard Gordon Kleiner define preaching as it was done in many of those days as a mild-mannered man, exhorting mild-mannered men to be more mild-mannered. We got pretty tired of it. I was here about I was here, I don't know, 6-10 months ago when we had a Foreign Mission Board trustee meeting here, and some of you with that. And I came away absolutely amazed. You had an orchestra then. I got back to Texas and said, it's like being in a Holy Roller meeting, being there in chapel. The singing was fun. And we got back to where we joined civilization instead of getting off in the monastery. Thank you for the music. It's been great. Now, if you let me be what I am, that is, someone whose whole life has been centered around missions, I want to share with you what I think are some of the most startling times and opportunities in the world, and I see if I could somehow let you feel some of the things I feel. But one of the lessons I learned a long time ago is the futility of trying to make somebody else have the convictions and the actions that God has patiently, gradually led me to have. So, relax. I'm going to talk about missions and God's will, but I'm not going to try to make you do anything. Several years ago, I resigned as general manager of the universe. It's been so relieving. But there are some things that have impressed themselves on me, and I'm well aware of the scripture in Psalm 127:1 that says, except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord plant in your heart convictions and actions that you see to be His will, you won't pay attention to a school teacher trying to make you do something. So I'm not going to try. I will try to share with you those things that are built in my own experience, in my own soul. And if they make any sense to you and they sound biblical and God says, hey, think about it and act on it, then we'll see what happens there. I'm going to tell you why I must be about my Father's business. And I think that includes mission, that includes all of us. I don't think a single one of us is exempt from that kind of responsibility. Let me read, first of all, New King James Version from Romans 3, beginning with the middle of verse 9. Romans 3, the middle of verse 9. We have charged both Jews and Greeks that they were all under sin. As it is written, there's none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands. There's none who seeks after God. They've all gone out of the way. They have together become unprofitable. There's none that does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of snakes is under their lips. Their mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. And the way of peace they have not known, because there is no fear of God before their eyes. If you read the newspaper day by day, you see that spread out before you in living action. That is today's world. And I'd like to drive a theological peg or two and then try to put in a practical suggestion for you to think about. And the main thing in the theological peg is to make a statement that I believe I must be about the Father's business, preaching a crucified, risen, saving Christ, because every human being without Christ is lost. He is guilty of rejection and rebellion against God, and he will spend eternity in hell. At the meeting of the Foreign Mission Board here these few months ago, they came up with a statement that dealt with that passage, and it stopped short of the last phrase. We believe man without Christ is lost. And one of the men on the board stood and said, why don't we make that statement as strong as it ought to be? And add to it, he will spend eternity in hell. We voted on it. We asked all the trustees to sign it. We're trying to say to the missionaries, this is the conviction of the men who are trustees. We hope you share it. And we hope you know something about the terrible excuses, the terrible situation of men without Christ. You see, God has given every human being who ever drew breath enough knowledge of Him through nature, conscience, and law to prove whether he will obey or rebel. And the first two chapters of Romans pick that up. If you look a bit in chapter 1, verse 20, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things he has made, his eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse. And in that chapter, and the next one, Paul underlines the chances people have to say to God, I will stand in awe of you, I will obey you, I will worship you, I see you as the great God of the universe. And Paul takes us through those three learning experiences, those three lessons every person can learn if he will, and says, when man sees creation, he refuses to worship the Creator. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork, and the old guy John says, "Fooey, I don't care." He said, if the Gentiles don't have a law, by conscience do the things the law calls for, they are law to themselves, but conscience says do right, and nearly all people insist on doing wrong. The law says do right, and Paul says it only makes you do wrong. So these three things all have one particular service to render. They teach everybody enough about God to find out whether he will obey or rebel. There is not enough in that for salvation, because nobody can obey that much. There is all you need there for everybody to stand guilty before God for rejecting the knowledge that he has. So when someone says, I haven't had enough knowledge to have a fair shake from God, you go back to this and say, did you obey what you learned from nature? Did you obey what you learned from conscience? Did you obey what you got from law? No, but I need more. And the theological implication is, if I will not obey that much light, I have no right to call for more. So one statement, every man without Christ is lost. He will spend eternity in hell, and he has no right to say, God, you didn't try to do anything for me. Now, salvation comes as an undeserved second chance. That's grace. But no man has the right to say, I deserve the death of Christ. I deserve 1,400 churches, chances more when I've already turned down 1,400. And we need to know that with this much guidance given to men to find out whether they will indeed obey or rebel, we need to be fully aware God does not send anybody to hell. Never. I hear people say the kind of God I worship wouldn't send anybody to hell. Well, I don't want their kind of God anyway, but mine wouldn't send anybody to hell either. He erected a cross right in the middle of a road toward hell and said, don't go. Don't go. I love you this much. Don't go. Don't go. So we dare not blame God. But there is a phrase there that it has the crack of doom in it. God gave them up. Not without attempt to bring them in, but said in each of these ways, when God tried to make himself known, people refused to know him, preferring their own way of life to his. And so those awful words ring out, God gave them up. Not because he didn't love them, but because there is such a thing as responsibility that is involved in human freedom. Now, there's a straw man that's sometimes paraded before us, and I remember that coming up in theology class with Dr. Connor one day. Somebody put this old straw man up. What about the heathen out there who does the best he can? Well, Dr. Connor's answer to that was, trot him out and let me take a look at him. I'd like to see the man who does the best he can. And I tried that out in classes for about 30 years, saying to people just like you, God called people, missionaries, preachers, and all the rest. How many of you men, yeah, I don't get in trouble with women. I just try to straighten out the men, let the women be all right. But I said, how many of you men have done the best you could in every situation for the last 24 hours? You went home yesterday afternoon after a hard test, and you were sort of mad at the professor and didn't do too well on the test, and you wanted to go home, and the kid came up and said, Daddy, would you go play ball with me? You just said, sure. You sat down to the paper, and your wife said, honey, you need to take the trash out. And without any back talk or sass, you just got up and towed out the trash. And you're reading the sports section, and your wife said, honey, it's time to take one of the kids back to the meeting down to church. And you just said, okay, be glad to. How many of you in the last 24 hours have done that well on everything? And in all these years, I've never had one single idiot to raise a hand and say, I have done all as well as I could for 24 whole hours. That's a straw man. That's against everything we know about human nature. So God does not send any man to hell, but he lets men make choices and reap the consequences of them. Now, universalism has come along as an answer for that. And that's a curse deliberately placed on a deceived race by people who try to be better than God. Pastor Russell tried to do away with hell when he created the Jehovah's Witnesses background. I was having breakfast one morning with a man who ran a bed and breakfast up in New England. He was a retired Unitarian preacher. He said people in New England grew tired of hearing about sin and God's judgment, so they just called the preachers and said there wasn't any. And if you read the history of Congregationalism in New England, people who wanted to feel they were all right without doing it God's way just changed their whole church. They just took down signs said Congregation and put up signs said Unitarian Universalist. And suddenly, there wasn't anybody going to hell. They'd just done away with it. Wouldn't that be wonderful if they could? But what they do is to deceive men. And those beautiful white churches that I saw all over New England have been turned into dance halls and things like that. There's not anything that I call church goes on in Unitarian Universalists. It is cowardice and compromise to fail to preach the biblical doctrine that man without Christ is lost and headed for an eternal hell. It is cowardice. It is betrayal of lost people. I don't like the doctrine of hell. It just wasn't mine to do away with it. And the motto in Faust's depiction was, all hope abandon, ye who enter here. Well, the second thing about that is, not only is man without Christ lost and headed for hell, but that man, those men, are dangerous to themselves and to the rest of the whole world. And we need to know the consequences of failing to share redemption with people who are in rebellion, because it affects us more than we know. We live in a global village. I think it was John Donne who said, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. And humanity is hurt wherever is our hurt here. Somehow, I picked up some of those places where everybody suffers because people do not know nor acknowledge God. A remarkable physician went out to Cambodia after finally the shooting stopped out. Most of it stopped out there. One day he went to an orphanage operated for the kids who'd been made orphans by the atrocities of Pol Pot, who tried to kill everybody who was educated. If a man wore glasses, he shot him because that would interfere with taking Cambodia back to first century communism if you had educated people. And in that process, this doctor met a little girl in the orphanage whose father had been shot by Pol Pot because he was educated. Her mother and sister had gone with her out to live in the woods, to live on roots and berries and leaves and whatever they could find. And the mother starved to death. And when Pol Pot wanted to clear the minefields that the invading Vietnamese had put between his soldiers who were outside of Phnom Penh so they wouldn't come back and put it between them and the capital, he wanted to clear the minefields without losing any soldiers in the process. So he lined up the children, 6, 8, 10, 12 years of age. His soldiers forced them to lock hands and march out across those minefields. And when this doctor, missionary doctor, asked the story of why this little girl was blind, the man who ran the orphanage said, in one of those marches across the minefield, her sister, hand in hand with her, stepped on a landmine and was blown to bits. And his description was, her eyes were turned forever inward. Could I go back to Romans 3? Is it accurate? Does it make sense? There's none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understand. There's none who seek after God. They're all gone out of the way. They've together become unprofitable. There's none who does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they practice deceit. The poison of snakes is under their lips. The mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. And the way of peace they have not known, because there's no fear of God before their eyes. Man without Christ is lost, and he is dangerous to all of us. That's my number two reason for saying I must be about my Father's business of spreading redemption. Number three, I must be about it because I am my brother's brother and I am my brother's keeper. Cain asked that stupid question. It was nothing but a dodge. Am I my brother's keeper? And God hardly condescended to give him an answer. It is written of the very nature of God and the nature of the Christian, if he is born again in God's image, that I am my brother's brother and I am my brother's keeper. And I have no right simply to enjoy grace without sharing it. I'm on the mission fields often. I compare our luxury with their poverty. I've been out in Bangladesh 7 different times. I go back this summer. Out there, when villages were destroyed by the invading armies from West Pakistan in that East-West Pak war, 30 million people were made homeless as their Muslim brothers, Urdus from the West, burned their little houses down, one room. Our missionaries rebuilt a lot of those things for $400 a house, one room, their style. And we put people back in the best house they'd ever owned. It'd be higher now. That was back in 1970s. We put them in the best one-room house they'd ever owned for $400. I go in homes here in America of Christian people, so-called, who spend from half a million to $1 million on houses they don't plan to stay in much anyway. And I wonder what kind of brother we are to the rest of the world. And we can spend that much money on houses that we don't need, not that kind of luxury, while other people can't even keep a roof over their head. We used to promise Christians in Africa, if you'll build everything but the roof, we'll get the tin to go on it, because that was the one thing they couldn't get the money to do. And now we're having to default out there all over Africa on that promise because we're not getting enough money to do it. And the Africans are saying, you told us if we'd put up the walls and the other things, you'd build the tin. The missionary said, I thought we're good. But we don't have enough money now to do it. I believe in missions because this is the greatest day for missions since Pentecost. That is not simply a cheerleader's rah-rah stuff. By the way, I was a cheerleader in high school, and a good one. The year I was cheerleader, our football team was unbeaten, untied, unscored on. Now, that's about as good as a cheerleader can do, I think. But that is not a cheerleader prediction, assumption. I've read through Latourette's 7-volume History of the Expansion of the Faith 10 different times for seminars. And with that background of knowing what's gone on since the return of Christ the Father, I want to tell you solemn judgment, if I have any, that this is the greatest day for missions since Pentecost. God is at work in a brand new way. If you read much of the Christmas story, it has a phrase, in the fullness of time, kairos, the Greek word, in the fullness of time, when all things had been drawn together by God, he came. I have a deep conviction we are in another kairos time, that God has broken down Berlin walls and communist dictatorships. When the first missionaries went to China, it took 6 months by sailing ship to get out there. 6 months to get mail one way. I'll go next summer. In less than 24 hours, I'll be in Bangkok. from Fort Worth, Texas. God has pulled together some days and made people accessible, and this is the greatest day for missions since Pentecost. Let me give you a set of figures that'll say something. In the year 100, there were 360 lost people to every born-again Christian. Overwhelming. In the year 1900, there were 27 lost people to every born-again Christian. By figures Ralph Winter has pulled together, today there are only 7 lost people to every Christian. Now, people told us we're falling behind, we're losing the race. That's not losing. The people who used to do missions and now just mess around doing social service and don't do any conversion thing say it's all over. Well, just find out where other people are doing it right. And there are more missionaries today than have ever been in the history of the faith. Barrett, the great researcher who's done the World Christian Handbook for years, says by the year 2000, Africa will become the major base for mission instead of the United States and Europe. And we're at a time where by that year there will be more missionaries from the two-thirds world than from the English-speaking world that's been the base of missions, because these people seem to be more obedient than we are. I wish I could have checked these figures. I just picked them up on the run. But there was a remarkable conference in Korea a few months ago, World Mission Conference there, and they asked how many Korean young people were willing to go to be missionaries, and I think my memory is accurate, 80,000 young Korean people said they were ready to go. It was a minimum of 40,000. I think it was 80. From Korea? Compare that to our feeling we got 4,000 and about 150, and we think that's big. There's something going on today. There's a movement called Dawn. It's an acrostic for discipling a whole nation. They say there are about 7 million churches. We want to get 7 million more in the next 10 years. And they're pulling together all the evangelical forces to do it. There's the AD 2000 movement with the same purpose. And there has never been a time in the history of the faith when the reports of people saved and congregations established were as thick and furious and encouraging as they are now. Thousands of churches are being planted, and we have more missionaries than ever all over the world. Moreover, for Southern Baptists, we have in place at the Foreign Mission Board the best leadership team we've ever had. And I say that from having studied the whole thing through its history. Jerry Rankin is a spirit-filled, spirit-led missionary leader. Avery Willis is vice president for overseas work. Avery learned what it was to walk in the Spirit while he's still in college. And if you studied Master Life, you pick up that with Avery, a note of spiritual depth, of quiet presence of the Holy Spirit that we don't always see in our leaders. When Jerry Rankin was elected, someone said to me, "What about a man nobody knows to head the Foreign Mission Board?" I said, "That's marvelous. Doesn't have any enemies, hadn't been in any fist fights, doesn't have anybody got to make peace with." But I said, "I've known him since he was a student. No man is smart enough in human wisdom to lead us out of our controversy and our problems, but Jerry Rankin doesn't have to. He has been led of the Holy Spirit ever since I've known him. And on a quiet, day-by-day basis, he'll lead with the wisdom of God." And I've sat there in the meetings these 2.5 years and watched that with awe and great appreciation. They're saying we want evangelism that results in churches. We not only evangelize, we congregationalize. You don't win people, leave them out there, freeze to death and starve to death alone. We try to evangelize people, evangelize others, and plant churches that will evangelize, plant other churches, and we're getting that emphasis played, and this somehow has come all together until here's my conviction. We have come to a time of God's ordaining. We didn't do it. God did. But I have such fear that we'll throw it away because we're going to keep on doing business as usual. So let me talk a little about the difference. If you've been in Southern Baptist life very long, you've heard the term bold mission thrust. That was put in to stir us up to missions, and we made some wonderful mottos, and we're going to have a bold mission thrust, and we're going to let everybody hear about Jesus by the year 2000. And in the first 2 years of all that shouting, we reduced the giving from the churches to the Cooperative Program Mission Fund by 10%. We talked a good game and played a very bad one. Slogans don't win the world. Sacrifice does. And we've had all the sloganeering we need. It's time to either put up or shut up. It's time to admit we're not going to do any sacrificing personally or in our churches, or it's time to get on with it. And I'm coming to another reason for saying we've got to have a new paradigm of our giving and a new awareness of what sacrifice is, because our volunteering is not, our giving is not keeping up with our volunteering. There are 3,000 candidates in the pipeline with the Foreign Mission Board, and unless giving increases, I don't like to give a discouraging word, but they're not going to go. And I began to see that close again in Texas right after WW2 when we were cutting down on our giving. We're doing it again under the judgment of God for betraying His opportunity that's here. Somehow, we need to come to a new paradigm in our giving, personally and in our churches. Somebody came up with the garbage statement that every church ought to give 10% to missions. I don't think there's a dime's worth of Bible truth in that at all. The dollar that goes into the local church collection plate does not belong to that church, those deacons, that pastor. That's God's dollar. His primary purpose is for a world to be saved. And if we show up at the judgment and throw this opportunity away, I think we'll have a very uncomfortable time facing Him when we get there. I believe every church, hear me now, pastors, all the rest of you, I believe every church ought to do all it does locally on 50% of the income and send the other 50 to win a world of Christ. And I'm not talking through my hat on that. I was pastor of a country church in Texas for 19 years when I was also teaching seminary and on a miserable salary from both of them. Let me be specific. I hired on to teach missions full time. I teach seminary full time for $200 a month. I'd always heard a good education paid, and I got a doctor's degree. Hired on with $200 a month. I'd do it again. Went to be pastor of a church after a little while. They said, we've been paying a student $35 a week, but now you're here, big professor, we could pay you more. I said, no, let's do more for missions. And living on those, on that combined salary and paying $1,000 of interest on our home and other things, cars every year, I led that church to give from 45 to 55% of all we handled for missions. Did it for years. Then they got to be big and cut it down to 5. And that's gone on all over Baptist life. The bigger we get, the more selfish we are. We build what we call family life centers. I call them tax-exempt country clubs, so we'll have a convenient place to play. And let a world go to hell. We buy these expensive buses to take our old folks to Branson, Missouri. That really wins the world, doesn't it? We all say the world out yonder is ready to hear, and we dare not be the watchman who doesn't give the warning. It says something to me personally. On that kind of income, way back into the 50s, Terry and I began to save $10 a month for our Light of Moon offering and $10 a month for our Christmas expense. And long ago, had a conviction, as much as we spend on everything for the family Christmas, we would match for the mission offering. And we had to begin in January. We wouldn't have anything in December. We prepared for it. We've increased that giving through the years as income increased. And this fall, the Lord said to me, your Lottie Moon offering this year is to be $5,000. That's not butter and egg money. It's Kairos money. That's opportunity money. That's important money. And as the trustees were talking about how to stretch the dollar, I said to them, let's not stretch the dollars we've got. Let us give so we have a right to tell others to give. And the average gift of the trustees was $2,000 this fall. We need a new dimension in our giving. The last thing that drives me to do something about missions, I hope it drives you, is because I love Jesus. And I like to do what he asked us to do before we left. Just two things. As he was going back to the Father, he said, I want you to love me and love each other. That's command number one. Number two, I want you to tell everybody about that love so they can have it too. That's all he asked. Two things. Final words. I think if we really love him, we want to fulfill what he wants us to fulfill, don't you? For 52 years, I had the best marriage I know on the earth. 3 years ago, we discovered she had uterine cancer. They told us to begin with. Nearly impossible to do much about it. We got all the treatment available. And finally, they said everything we've done has damaged. Nothing has improved her body. She was eaten up with tumors. No more tricks in the medical field. She said, I want to die at home, where we'd reared our family for most of our married years. I'm not a nurse, don't know much about medicine. But I took Terry home. We called the hospice people. First visit, they said to me, now next visit, we'll tell you who will be her primary caregiver. I said, you need not worry about that. I'm primary. Everybody else is next. And for 2 months, I fulfilled her last wish to spend those last days at home. Had to change her diaper like a baby. She lost control with the awfulness of cancer. And I have never had a greater privilege in my life than fulfilling the marriage vow and married love by waiting on her those 2 months. I'd do it again in a minute. But there's some wishes of Jesus that he wants us to fulfill. And I want to do it, and I hope you do too. Loving Father, forgive us for seeing the most unselfish expression on earth as Jesus left heaven to be persecuted and killed on earth for our salvation. Oh, dear Father, let us somehow learn that you expect us to respond in kind, that it is not your will that any should perish, that all should come to salvation. And in this day of opportunity, oh God, guide us so we don't fail thee and the people Jesus died to save. For Jesus' sake. Amen.
Thank you, Dr. Guy. You come here and visit with him a moment and greet him as you leave. And I want to challenge you, if you'll join me, in being willing for God to give us a whole new way of thinking about our giving, about our sacrifice.